It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Playing outside is important. As outdoor playtime has dwindled for many kids in the United States, our understanding of the importance of that time has grown. This hour, I'll talk with people who are making outdoor play a priority. But first, we're going to start on the playground. Bambi Yost is an assistant professor of landscape architecture at Iowa State University, and she's working on a project to design and implement better playgrounds at inner city schools in Philadelphia. Hello, Bambi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And you're focusing in your project, you're focusing your work in Philadelphia. And I'd love for you to create a contrast for me. What do you see on some of the school grounds, the playgrounds in Philadelphia that you feel need the most help?
Well, most of the Philadelphia playgrounds, honestly, are asphalt. They are giant parking lots, oftentimes used as particular parking lots for the schools themselves, the teachers, because there's limited parking in these inner cities. And this is not just the case for Philly. I mean, this is actually true for many, many urban centers across the U.S. What happens with school districts is they don't have the money and they don't have the time and resources to actually maintain a cultivated or green schoolyard. And so at least that's their mentality. And so they typically pave them, especially when they have a small site. And you have an entire parking lot that is just cracked asphalt, hotter than you can possibly imagine. You may have the occasional tree or two in there. And oftentimes, they're pretty much neglected. There's a lot of trash and litter. Now, that said, there are a lot of different small groups, you know, neighborhood organizations that have been trying to make changes happen. And what you'll find is you'll have a couple different schools that'll have, you know, some raised beds because they're allowed to do things that aren't permanent. They can do temporary installations without having to seek school district approval. And so with those raised garden beds, you know, the kids at least have some opportunities to grow things and to have engagement, you know, with green living plant materials. But in particular, you know, certain areas, it's an odd thing. They've got public-private partnerships where the neighborhood actually owns the play equipment. And they maintain play equipment on some of these school grounds. And then other times, you know, there's just nothing there. So it's quite varied, I guess, is the way to say it. And when I go in and I see what the kids have, you know, for their play environment, they don't even have things painted on the ground plane. So it's pretty limited in general. And it's definitely not something that's stimulating for them in terms of mental, you know, emotional, physical, any kind of interaction that they need for their own growth.
And as you mentioned, I mean, this is not just something that's happening in Philadelphia. It's happening all over the country.
Yeah, yeah. And when so I started doing playgrounds in Denver, and at that time we were dealing with in Denver school district, they had play equipment from 1950s. It was predominantly pea gravel surfaces with asphalt. They did have this play equipment in place, but it was all outdated and it was no longer meeting safety codes. So they had to replace everything. They didn't know how to go about doing it. And Lois Brink and I, she's a professor there at the University of Colorado. She spearheaded the Learning Landscapes Initiative. And she's now the strategic officer, or I can't remember, chief strategist, that's her title, at the Big Sandbox. So she and I worked in Denver on schoolyards and with the school district there. And we were able to rebuild 96 all of the public elementary schools in town. And so far, that contrast, you know, from Denver to Philly, what I find so amazing is Philadelphia has no loss of water. I mean, it rains all the time there. They can definitely grow things. All the parks are really lush and green. And yet the schoolyards are these vacant lots, right? And in Denver, you know, we had at least the excuse that you didn't get a lot of rain. So for me, it's really sad to go someplace where you know things can grow and you can have like a wealth of opportunity for living systems, you know, an outdoor educational curriculum that's focused on science and health and well-being. And none of that is possible if you just have a parking lot.
So as you are working to transform these playgrounds, what is important? I mean, I don't want to talk about the ideal playground necessarily, but what do you think is vital to a healthy playground?
Well, honestly, I think most of this stems from the community needs. And so we do what's called community-based planning, which means we go in and we actually meet with the neighbors, we meet with the school, you know, teachers, the principal, try to get the district involved. We meet with all the kids, who ask for their input because you want to know what they want. It doesn't make any sense to build something that somebody doesn't want. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't suggest certain things. Like, you know, we know for a fact that shade is going to increase active use on a playground when it's 100 degrees out, right? So you want to have trees. You want to have some sort of a shade canopy. You ideally want to make this place something that is clearly a landmark, clearly valued. And what we've found is that kids in particular really like gateways because it signifies that they're walking into their own zone. It's a place for them. You know, parents don't think about gateways as being all that important. But for kids, it's really important. And neighbors really want these little tiny pocket parks, right? So we're trying to really, truly create little multi-generational pocket parks that then get spread throughout the city as part of this play environment. So it's not just about a playground for kids, and it's not just about thinking about it in terms of scholastic achievement and what kids can gain, but it's really trying to think about the entire community as a whole. And ideally, what happens is if you can expand that, you know, beyond the one little block where that school is and think of it as a system throughout the entire city, you then increase the opportunity for habitat, you increase the opportunities for stormwater retention, opportunities for community engagement. You know, these become civic spaces that are used and utilized. They become havens of, you know, green, shady, cool areas that otherwise wouldn't exist.
Now, when you look at a playground, you can guess pretty close to when it was built because playground equipment has a, it's sort of like a, the fashion industry. There's a style of playground equipment that is popular at a certain time. Now that people have really been focusing on research and trying to understand what kind of playground equipment gets used and also inspires physical activity, actual muscle building activity, what do you feel are the most valuable pieces of equipment to have on a playground?
Yeah, that's a question. You know, honestly, I think almost all of the equipment today is so safe, it's really not as challenging as it could be or should be for most kids at, you know, after a certain age. And that is something that, you know, I personally have as an interest is these perceptions of risk and risky play. So a lot of the play equipment is very static. They're trying to make things that are more, that require more upper body strength, for example, or core strength, balance, the ability to progress through a series of, you know, different stages on play equipment, but it's very hard to monitor. So what happens is you can put up signs that say, you know, this is only for like 3-year-olds to 6-year-olds and hope that nobody else goes on it. But of course, other kids are going to go on that play equipment. And the same thing is true if you put in play equipment and you have a sign that says it's for like 12-year-olds and above. And so with each of those age limits, you typically have a growth increase in terms of what their skill set needs to be. So there's a lot of really good play equipment out on the market now compared to when I started doing this in, you know, early 2000s. And what I would say is most of them are really trying to push the boundaries as to what is considered like fun and active and challenging, but also safe. And I think, honestly, the surface is the biggest issue. So the fall surface is where most of the injuries occur. And most people don't think about that. And it's kept as a separate thing from play equipment, right? Because play equipment itself, everybody just thinks we just have to get the play equipment. But in reality, it's what you fall on, which is what matters most. Because when you fall on a surface that's hard, you're more likely to break bones. And there hasn't been a really good connection in terms of like coming up with something that's really spongy and bouncy and great and allows you to fall from a fairly high distance, maybe over 6 feet high, and still not get injured, right? So different play equipment today that I recommend, you know, and I really enjoy having my students like explore is circuit play, just because you can have more students on it than your traditional platform play. And so platform play is what you picture when you see a castle, right? And it's got like that little tent that's at the top, right? And all the kids run up and they're on the ramp and they have to go through one or two at a time. If you do circuit play, it tends to be more linear. It doesn't look as cool, but it actually allows you to do more with your body. So you can climb over it. You can climb along it in a linear form. There are different ways of approaching it from a physical education perspective.
I'm having a hard time imagining what that looks like. Can you be more descriptive?
It looks like circuit play equipment is traditionally just like long skinny climbing bars, for example, that you could climb straight up or you could climb across. It might be a big grid and it just looks like a flat surface, almost like a wall that's a grid, where you could climb across it, over it, around it. And it would be a long linear piece. And then there might be something next to it that would be maybe ropes coming down with little things that you could stand on with your feet. So you could walk, like you can basically climb this like a climbing wall that's a lateral climbing wall. I don't really know how to describe this very well. It's a challenge.
All right.
But it's a different type of play equipment. And we experimented with it.
Not the fortress, not the little
castle. It's not the fortress, no.
All right. So, and I also, before we get to the break, green space is really important in all of your playground designs. And I know that's something that a lot of people fear because of the upkeep. But what kind of green space do you feel is essential?
Yeah, trees in particular. I can't say enough for trees. I mean, honestly, if you just put a tree with a giant tree well that can actually gain stormwater, it will help control stormwater runoff immensely, and it'll provide shade. And once they're large enough, it's very hard to vandalize them, and they tend to last forever. So trees are my number one go-to, and you want to always put in at least a 2-inch caliber or above because you want it to be substantial enough that kids can't injure it, you know, unintentionally or even intentionally. Second to that, I would say you want really hardy things, and shrubs tend to do better than small plantings. So ideally you go for something again that's hardy, like lilac bushes. They have something colorful spring, you know, they smell great. They can deal with drought, they can deal with, you know, hard, heavy rains. So we always look for plants that are extremely, extremely hardy. And ideally, it gives something back to the kids as well. So it gets them engaged and it's something they like and they'll remember. Because we want these to be places they remember and love.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking this hour about the importance of play and playgrounds as well. Bambi Yost is an assistant professor of landscape architecture at Iowa State University. She and her students are working on a project to design and implement better playgrounds at schools in Philadelphia. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. We'd love to hear from you as well. What do you think is important in a playground? Do you feel like your kids get enough time to play? This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about playgrounds and play. And of course, a great playground is a wonderful thing, but it doesn't do much if kids don't have time to play. Now we're going to focus on the importance of play, how to make time and space for physical play. As an educator and a parent, you are welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Bambi Yost. She's an assistant professor of landscape architecture at Iowa State University, and she and her students are working on a project to design and implement better playgrounds at inner city schools in Philadelphia. And I also want to bring a number of other people into the conversation now, starting with Dr. Stuart Brown. He's a psychologist and the founding director of the National Institute for Play. He is also the author of Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. Hello, Stuart.
Hello. Happy to be with you today.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I think sometimes when we talk about the importance of play in childhood, a lot of people think, well, of course, you know, kids play. That's something that they do. But we have had to make it a field of study. What are we missing in our culture right now that we have to focus on talking about the importance of making time for kids to play?
Well, I think play is such a central issue in kids' lives that without it, particularly without it being initiated from within by the kids' own spirit, that there really are consequences when adults organize it excessively, mm-hmm. or when every moment is planned. You know, you got to go to ballet or gymnastics or play Little League, and these are not necessarily in harmony with the interior desire of the kid for whatever engages him or her. So if you look at the developmental trajectory of life, a life with healthy play is often a life filled with well-being. A life without healthy play is often rigid and not nearly as fulfilling.
Describe healthy play for me. What's the definition?
Well, healthy play is something that's done for its own sake. It is enjoyable or fun. it takes you to the next level, usually, if you're engaged in something you really enjoy, whether it's climbing on a playground or chase and escape in a playground tag, you get better at it because you like it and you're doing it and you want to master the next level of excellence. So part of the intrinsic nature of play is to take you to the next step of excellence. And it really is driven from deep motivation from within whoever you are. And it's very individualized. You know, not everybody likes to wrestle and chase on the playground. Some are collect four-leaf clovers on the side of the playground, but it's still play.
Now, I think a lot of parents today struggle with getting their kids to go outside and play. Sure. Of course, screens are very attractive, and I certainly have these battles with my kids. Sometimes I'll get them to go outside, and then they'll say, well, there's nothing to do. So how do you facilitate healthy play if you're not supposed to structure it and tell them what to do?
It's very tough. I think the ability to go from boredom to enchantment in a natural setting often takes a good deal of patience and wisdom on the part of the parent or the teacher. But, you know, I've got a grandchild, and I took him hiking about, 6 months or so ago in the area where I live, and he was bored, and it was kind of hot, and he didn't like what was going on, and he was griping. He wanted to get back to his video games. But shortly into the hike, a hawk flew over carrying a snake. And he said, cool! And he got really involved in beginning to look at the enchantment that's there within nature herself. So there's no simple formula that I think tells a parent what to do, but I think the ability of a child who is bored to then find something from within themselves that gets them going is possible, but it takes parental wisdom to let them kind of whine and moan about how bored it is and how much more immediate the screens are.
And you talked about some of the things that take away from playtime, all of the enrichment activities that are available for our kids today. And it's hard not to take advantage of a lot of these great opportunities that we really didn't have when we were kids. So what I think parents who are really concerned about making sure that their kids are getting the most out of life need a reason to set aside time for unstructured play. What do kids get out of that play?
Well, I think it's so broad-ranging what they get out of it. And the research that's being done on where you can objectify play in social mammals in a laboratory and compare that with what happens to play in real life with kids is really fascinating because the engagement process that is driven from the deep intrinsic motivation of the child is something that the teacher and the parent need to take a look at and understand. You know, are kids more tinkerers? Are they physical? Are they imaginative? What turns them on and produces a sense of real glee and continued engagement, and then nourishing those particular tendencies, all of which are playful, is really a cue to finding how those kids can build on their innate talents. And that concept, play and innate talents, play and going to the next step of mastery, are not things that the average parent or teacher knows or thinks about. They think play is trivial and, get them in doing something that's going to be productive so they can get into the right college or get the right job. And the paradox about play is that when there is a sufficient amount of natural, engaged, free play, the outcomes, both academic and in terms of overall emotional health, are phenomenally good. So, play works.
Stuart Brown is the founding director of the National Institute for Play. I want to bring a couple of other voices into the conversation here, too. And a lot of teachers, we've seen research that show us that time spent being physical also has a payoff in cognitive abilities and the ability to focus and do well on tests and all kinds of things. And Jan Granko-Lehman is a physical education teacher at Grantwood Elementary School in Iowa City. And Jan, you probably see that when kids spend time running around having fun at recess. Can you see when they return to the school a difference?
You can see that they've burned off some of that nervous energy that if they're not allowed to move, they're going to fidget in the classroom. They're not going to be as attentive to what's happening academics. We're trying to implement some brain breaks prior to our Iowa testing, and we found out that it works. They're more engaged, and it's helping academically as well as helping them physically.
And what's a brain break?
A brain break may be a 1 minute, get out of your chair, let's do some jumping jacks, let's move around, kind of a structured activity, but it allows kids who shouldn't be sitting longer than 20 minutes at a time. You have a little sensor in your tailbone that says, I've been sitting, I should go to sleep, and you're going to watch your students lose focus over time. And so if you can get them up and moving, they're going to be better engaged, and you have a better chance academically to make that learning happen.
Now, we're focusing on play. Of course, you have kids come into your gym or your field, and it's your job to facilitate play with kids and also help them build healthy muscles and increase endurance and all of those good things. How have you seen physical education change over your time as a teacher?
Over the time, we've gone to less competitive, more lifetime skill focus, allowing the kids to find an activity that they're going to carry out through the rest of their life, because we know it's important to teach them not only about their bodies and how it moves, but what's important to carry on through the rest of their life so they can maintain that healthy individual as they go on to high school and college and then have their own children to be able to get them outside and moving.
Now, of course, a lot of school districts have seen physical education time cut back over the years. There's actually, in the Iowa City schools, been a minor increase just in the past year. But give me an idea over time how that's fluctuated as well.
We've been pretty steady due to our bell schedule this year. We've allowed us to increase just a small amount, but we'll take anything we can get because we think it's important. It's physical education makes that total student it's a foundation of their education, and we think it's important, as well as the time with the recess. Our Iowa City wellness policy has a time allotment for each grade level, and I think parents should be an advocate to make sure that that's happening, because that playtime, not only structured in physical education, but the unstructured time outside is extremely important.
And in the Iowa City schools, the school day was extended by 45 minutes this past year. So the school day got longer, which did allow for a little more physical education, but it didn't change recess times, did it?
It did not. We stayed with time allotment is 50 minutes a day for kindergarten through third grade. We have 35 minutes for fourth grade and 20 minutes for fifth and sixth graders. So if you look at the whole day, that's not a whole lot of movement time. That's why we think it's important to not only have the physical education, but allow for the brain breaks to get those kids up and moving.
Both of my kids are in elementary school in the Iowa City area, and I've noticed that some of their teachers actually implement extra recesses during the day. They're in fifth grade. My daughter, her teacher made it a priority to make sure the kids got outside in the afternoon, too, because they did only have that 20 minutes of recess time. So some teachers are doing this on their own. But I would love to know, from talking with teachers that you work with, how do teachers feel about the amount of recess time that kids get during the day?
Often they feel it's not enough because we're heavy on the academic end. Different guidelines have changed over the years, requiring more class time, more seat time. And so when they have the opportunity to take students outside, They look for those small windows and get them out because they know it's important to get them moving.
It's kind of a catch-22 because there's all this emphasis on test scores, and now research has shown that physical activity improves test scores, but there's less time for the physical activity.
It is nice when we see teachers who are taking their academics outside, that it may be a science lesson that they could do outside and kids are moving as they do it, or a math lesson that they're outside. So starting to incorporate more of that, I think, is making a difference.
As a physical education teacher, do you feel like it's important to be outside when you can?
I think you should be outside every chance you get.
When you have the kids outside as opposed to in the gym, do you see a difference in their behavior?
I do. Just the freedom, the bigger space. To be engaged in the activity, they just enjoy being outside because it doesn't happen as much with all the screen time that students have.
Do you, we were talking earlier, I was talking to Dr. Brown about how sometimes when you send kids outside, they say, I don't know what to do. Do you see that? Do you see kids who maybe they don't play outside very much and they kind of are at a loss for what to do when they get out there?
I see that an awful lot. When we were kids, there were no cell phones. There were no computers. You just went outside and play, and you allowed your imagination to take over. You learned how to work with other people. You learned how to communicate on what you wanted to play or negotiate or problem solve. And sometimes students today need that little nudge on how to play on their own.
How do you nudge a kid?
With a lot of times with play structure, they allow for that imagination to happen. There may be little windows that look like stores or steering wheels or bubble windows where you can allow that imagination if you just give them that push to say, have you thought about this? And that opens up a whole new world for the student.
When you, I realize that as a phys ed teacher, recess is not one of your responsibilities, but you get to see a little bit of recess play as well. When you watch the kids, what do they gravitate toward? What seems to be working best on the playground at your school?
It depends on the age level. The younger kids, we're going to see them play a lot of tag. To go up and down the slides and enjoy the ladders. The older kids, they may gravitate towards our basketball court. But we're putting in, at our school, now three structures, so they're age-appropriate to where we have a pre-K, a 1 playground, a 2-3 playground, and then a 4-5-6 grade level playground that allows for growth with them, more upper body with the older kids, more imagination with the younger students.
Bambi, when you're listening to Jan talk about what works out at recess, does that jive with what you've learned through the research you've done about what kind of play equipment really gets kids moving?
Yeah, I agree completely with the imaginative play, especially for younger children, you know, seeing the storefront on the play equipment itself. I've found that swings are probably the number one activity that kids gravitate towards. Unfortunately, the limitation there is that you can only have one kid on a swing at a time.
Right.
So next to that, I would say grass fields are always a big attractor, too, at least on our schoolyards. And typically, you know, we also have found that kids are not necessarily as able, you know, to go out and just like run around and do things on their own. They tend to be a little more social now, especially the females. The research that we did in Denver indicated that our schoolyards improved or they enhanced play opportunities for male students, but they enhanced socialization opportunities for female students in particular. And that was really interesting to see. It had nothing to do with the play equipment per se, as much as it did with these small little pockets and zones and how you would set up seating or, you know, create places for people to gather. And those are all important things. You know, it's really important to have socialization skills, just as Jan was commenting on, that it's a necessary lifelong thing to learn how to cooperate with others. And it's also really important for these students to have a place to just be on their own and talk outside of an academic setting.
Even if they may not be actually building muscles they're out there. And Jan, you wanted to weigh in on that.
I will say we have a few benches that are on the outskirts of our play equipment, and you will tend to see students sit there and have that social time.
Yeah, and I think that's huge, because part of the problem with the screen time is that kids are really learning, you know, how to socialize only through this media. They don't understand how to really socialize and communicate with one another face-to-face as well. So
we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Bambi Yost, Assistant Professor of Landscape Architecture at Iowa State University. She's working on a project to design and implement better playgrounds in Philadelphia. Dr. Stuart Brown is a psychologist and the founding director of the National Institute for Play. And Jan Granko-Lehman is a physical education teacher at Grant Wood Elementary School in Iowa City. We also want to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about playgrounds and the importance of play. We'd love for you to join the conversation. If you are an educator, if you're a parent, if you have something to say about this, let us know. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Stuart Brown. He's a psychologist and the founding director of the National Institute for Play. He is also the author of Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. Bambi Yost is here. She's an assistant professor of landscape architecture at Iowa State University. She's working on a project to design and implement better playgrounds at inner city schools in Philadelphia, along with her students. And also Jan Granko-Lehman is here. She's a physical education teacher at Grant Wood Elementary School in Iowa City. And we're going to bring a kinesiologist into the conversation in just a moment, but I also want to get to a question from one of our listeners. This is from Katie. She says, on a trip to Wales a few years ago, we were lucky enough to stumble upon what I would describe as a natural playscape designed to foster imaginative play. Among other features, a climbing frame made of logs, a small creek with a bridge, a small hill built up with the suggestion of a fort or a hill on top made with natural materials, and very best of all, a dragon made from mounded earth, think effigy mound style, with recycled tires for spines out of its back. It was utterly fantastic. Is there a movement for this type of playground in the United States? I'd love to have one close to home. And is there one in Iowa that you know of? Stuart Brown, I'll start with you, because I know that you feel pretty strongly about this kind of adventure playground.
I sure do. And I've been to that place in Wales, and there are adventure playgrounds that are springing up around the U.S. You know, there's one in Berkeley. There's a grand one in Austin, Texas. And I think they're being built in a number of places where there are sort of natural mud, sand, wood, scraps that kids themselves jump into and begin to create, like was described in the whales, a dinosaur or an imaginative effigy, some sort of thing that springs right out of their imagination. And they're really, when you watch kids in these adventure playgrounds, they're really invested in what they're doing, and they do cooperative kinds of projects. It's really fun.
And yes. Bambi, you were mentioning earlier that you are also drawn to this kind of thing, and as somebody who builds playgrounds at schools, I'm sure there's kind of a push and pull for you, because of course safety is really important.
Yeah, there really is a challenge there, and it honestly falls in the hands of the school district, because it's all about, you know, liability. The bottom line is lawyers, you know, lawsuits and liability. So that's true for play equipment vendors, just as it is for a school district. And it takes a huge amount of effort, you know, for an entire community to get a cultural change or shift in perspective as to what is and is not considered safe or risky. And, you know, adventure playgrounds are awesome. I think they're just amazingly great here in the United States. You know, of course, they're always managed. Like, you don't go in there alone completely. There are always adult play supervisors to some extent. You know, they basically are there to help you as a child, like, find tools or do different things and make sure you stay safe. And there were more adventure playgrounds in Europe, you know, but even there, they've started to have more and more of a fear of litigation. And unfortunately, that then pushes back towards a school district, right? So a school district that's already impoverished, doesn't have a lot of money to even fund, you know, their teachers, let alone buy supplies for their kids, they don't want anything to do with a lawsuit. So they are always, always very, very risk averse. And it makes sense. Denver was fortunately able to have a $150,000 lawsuit cap. So no matter what would happen on the school grounds when we were working there, anyone, if a kid were injured, the parents could only sue for up to $150,000. There was only ever one major incident that occurred where that went into a court proceeding while I was working on that school project area. However, you know, the risk is really minimal. This is what's really interesting. So when you look at the data, there really are not that many injuries occurring on schoolyards in particular. Most injuries really happen in your own backyard. So your kid is more likely to actually break their arm falling off of a piece of play equipment at the neighbor's house than, you know, going into the schoolyard or going down to the park. And a lot of times that, again, it comes with the fall surface zone. So where they're falling is critical.
I want to bring our kinesiologist into the conversation now. Spiridula Vasu is assistant professor of kinesiology at Iowa State University, and she studies ways to get kids moving at different ages. Hello, Spiridula.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
And tell us a little bit about you. You focus your research on different age groups, and we've been talking primarily about school-aged kids right now, and we'll talk more about younger kids in a moment. But as far as getting school-aged kids up and moving and building those muscles and being strong and healthy, what have you found is the key?
Well, it's very, very important to provide variability so that the kids will find ways and have activities that are cognitively engaging, you know, make their brain, stimulate their brain and find more than one solutions in a problem and not just be very direct supervision of you can do only one thing and everybody does the same thing. So having opportunity and a lot of variability in their practice and what they do stimulates the brain, actually, you know, fires up the brain and areas of the brain like the prefrontal cortex, which is very important for learning. So we need to realize that it's not just running. It's not only the aerobic exercise that helps the brain, but it is a lot of motor complexity, coordination, and a lot of cognitive engagement. Imagination, as they said, and most importantly, needs to be fun, you know, engaging and fun.
Well, that sounds just like recess. So is that important to just make sure that kids go outside with other children and don't have the opportunity to access screens while they do it? Is that kind of the recipe for success?
Absolutely. And the more breaks we can have throughout the school day, the better it is. And even if we cannot let the kids go out, even in the classroom, in the gym, wherever we can provide opportunities for different types of activities, even if they are supervised by adults, but provide many solutions to a problem, it's still considered very cognitively engaging and it's very beneficial. And also, you know, a lot of social interaction. It's not every child on their own working on a solution and motor skill complexity solution, but interacting with their peers and coordinate on finding a solution to a problem.
Is there a specific recommended amount of recess time that seems to be optimal during the day?
There isn't really, you know, minimum. So the more we can have, the better it is. The problem is how much can schools offer. And unfortunately, only a 20 minutes period of recess is not enough. We need to have more and more and more breaks throughout the school day. There isn't really a research that tells us it's every X minutes, even though we might hear that sometimes, you know, advocates say every 30 minutes or every 40 minutes, but there isn't really clear research evidence. But because everybody is stimulated differently, so the attention span for the kids is very short. And some kids might have shorter, some might have longer. Especially hyperactive kids, they might need breaks more often. So there isn't one solution. Everybody should have a break every 30 minutes, but it should be individualized and respond and reflect to the needs of every child.
And Jan was mentioning earlier these brain breaks, which might be as short as 1 or 2 minutes, right, Jan?
Correct.
So, Spiridula, does that make a difference if you get up and move around for 2 minutes? Do we see that influences how kids learn?
Absolutely.
Oh, Stuart,
if the kids are involved in three-dimensional activity with a little gravity pulling on them, that we know that stimulates the cerebellum. The cerebellum then fires up things in the prefrontal cortex, and the kids learn better.
So even a little bit goes a long way.
A little bit. But Finland, has a break after every class in their elementary schools, and they've got the highest academic outcome of virtually any school in Europe. So there are some evidences that breaks in recess time and long-term academic accomplishment go together.
We have an email from Shauna in Des Moines who says, it seems faulty to focus on schools and the erasure of play in our society. For whatever reason, we don't value unstructured play. My kids and I are outside during the day every single day, and there are many days we don't see another child outdoors. This may sound unbelievable, but it's true. We, as a society, kids and adults, have turned indoors, leaving outdoor activity as an afterthought or a big production, organized hikes, etc. It seems to me that schools are simply a mirror for society. She also says there are two natural playscapes in the Des Moines area, one at McHenry Park and one at Jester Park. So that was an answer to a question that we had earlier about those playscapes, the sort of adventure play that we were talking about. And I would love for all of you to comment on that, how we've turned away from going outside as a culture. And Stuart, I'll let you go first. I mean, should we be focusing on schools, or does the focus need to be elsewhere?
It's a really complex issue. Joe Frost has written a book, The History of Childhood Play, and he's a play expert from Austin, Texas. And he thinks that we are living in a crisis that's really unprecedented with kids not being outside. And that the involvement of kids with nature and with each other, particularly in the rough and tumble risk-taking that is a natural part of play, is an absolute requirement for later development of tolerance and empathy and social nuances between individuals. So I think, yes, there is a withdrawal. There's 71% in the UK. They did a study. Kids are 71% less involved in outdoor activities now than they were 10 years ago in the UK. And so it's a public health issue. It needs to be the benefits of play need to be understood both for personal health and for brain development and for social competency. And we don't somehow see play as being connected to that, and yet it is.
Well, and Jan, I want to turn to you as a physical education teacher. It seems like in the past years we have put more and more responsibility for raising our children on the shoulders of people who are involved in the school, and here we're saying, okay, they need to get enough exercise while they're at school too. Does that seem frustrating? I mean, you get them for how long every week? Is it 30-minute periods or
27-minute periods?
27-minute periods.
Wow.
So you get them nearly an hour and a half a week. That's not a lot of time.
It's not a lot of time, and we're dependent on parents. But I think in this day and age, I want to ask everybody else if they think this is part of the problem, is when you have both parents working and you have children at home, how often are they allowed to go outside if they're not supervised and there's not an adult in the area? Is it become a society where you don't play outside unless parents are home? And if parents are working 8 to 12 hours a day, there's not a whole lot of playtime outside. And that's if you drive through neighborhoods, you really don't see kids outside anymore.
Well, and Stuart, I'll let you respond to that as well, because that returns to what Shauna was saying. Now, not everybody gets to spend all day outside with their kids. What's your thought on what Jan brought up?
Well, I agree with the phenomenon. There's not a simple answer, because there is a sense of pervasive fear that if the kid is left alone in a park, there's going to be a pervert that's going to get them. And yet the actual statistics indicate that the dangers are less now in open in parklands in most neighborhoods, not in all for sure.
Although the danger of being reported to the Department of Human Services for not watching your child, that has grown a lot in the United States,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that's happened. And, you know, I think a woman by the name of Lenore Scanese has written some fun stuff about her kids riding the subway. And she gets dinged by family services or some such thing. So I think it's a cultural, we need to have cultural awareness of the good science behind what I'd say are the benefits of play. And that needs to be pervasive for parents and for schools and for the public health. And I think if that information is somehow felt, not just thought about, but felt, then the behavior may well change, like it did with smoking and lung cancer, for example. But it's a tough uphill fight, and the demands of school districts for kids to get good test scores and the demands on the teachers and the demands on the parents to feel like they're being responsible for their kids if there is open time, all of these tend to, I think, lessen access to free play.
And I want to get one more caller on the air. Christine is on the line in Reading, Pennsylvania. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question? Very quickly.
I'd just like to hear a little bit more about engagement. I think it's wonderful that these students are trying to, you know, be involved in community engagement, and a little bit more about what that looks like. And our elementary and kids for whom these playgrounds are being planned, are they also in on the planning?
Right. Bambi, you were talking about that earlier, the community engagement in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Who has input?
Everyone has input. And so we do a series of different things. We have design charrettes actually at the schools with the kids and community members. We tend to keep them separate because kids want separate things. And we always put the kids' voices first. And that is because they are so often just ignored, unfortunately, and their wishes are not heard. So what we find is we'll do a series of drawings with all age groups. The kids that are under third grade and under, typically have the most creative input, and they are the ones who want the most imaginative things. They're the ones coming up with the giant dragon or the castle and things along those lines. And what's really fun to do then is take these drawings that kids have done and actually implement them into a design and have it physically be built. So in Denver, we were able to do that. In Philadelphia, we're still at the ground stage right now where we're doing more master planning. We're working our way into implementation planning in this next fall coming up with a couple schools building off of the community design collaborative's already existing master plans as well as some of the master plans that we did last fall. So, yeah, I think it's an important thing. My students in particular really value it as well because they get to know community members outside of Iowa. They get to see what it's like to live in a very diverse culture, and they also learn more about what it's like to be in an inner city with limited resources.
Well, Bambi Yost, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Bambi Yost, Assistant Professor of Landscape Architecture at Iowa State University. Also, thank you to Dr. Stuart Brown, a psychologist and the founding director of the National Institute for Play, Jan Granko Lehman, phys ed teacher at Grantwood Elementary School in Iowa City, and Spiridula Vasu, Assistant Professor of Kinesiology at ISU. This is Talk of Iowa.